A Massachusetts company is hoping that in a few years, you'll be able to buy its genetically modified salmon in the grocery store. That'd be the first genetically modified animal cleared for human consumption. But, and it's a big but, the company needs approval from the Food and Drug Administration. From regulatory concerns to the environmental impact, this hour we look at the debate over the science and safety of bioengineered fish. Plus, pythons are known to swallow prey as big as a deer. But a group of researchers say what's really amazing is the snake's hearts grow by 40% in a matter of days after a big meal. Coming up, we take a look at how fat helps the python have a healthy heart. After this.
Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. Ira Flato is away this week. The biotech company Aqua Bounty Technologies of Waltham, Massachusetts, has developed a genetically modified Atlantic salmon that grows twice as fast as regular salmon. How has it done this? By tinkering with the salmon's genome, adding a growth hormone gene from one fish plus an antifreeze gene from another. The result, fish that grow to market size rapidly. Aqua Bounty's application to market these bioengineered fish has been under FDA review for 15 years. Last fall, the Food and Drug Administration held a public hearing and convened a panel of experts to review the food safety and environmental risks posed by these salmon. Their conclusion? Aqua Bounty salmon was safe as food from conventional Atlantic salmon. But some scientists and environmental groups have said their questions about the safety of genetically modified fish remain unanswered. This hour, the science and safety of bioengineered fish. And joining us for this discussion is Dr. Allison von Inenum. She's an extension specialist in animal genomics and biotechnology at University of California, Davis. She was on the FDA's panel of experts that evaluated Aqua Bounty's proposal last year. She co-authored a piece in Nature Biotechnology about the company's regulatory battle. She joins us from Eugene, Oregon. Welcome, Dr. von Inenum.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon. And also with us is Dr. Anne Kapuscinski. She's a professor of sustainability science and chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Dartmouth College. She has been a scientific advisor to the federal government on several issues relating to genetically modified organisms, and she joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kapuscinski.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon. And if you want to weigh in on the science and the safety of genetically modified salmon, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us your question by writing the @ followed by SciFry. And there's also more information on the website, www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. So, Dr. von Inenum, let's start with you. You were on this committee that was evaluating. How long did you have to evaluate the company's data saying this food is this fish is safe to eat and safe to grow and release into the marketplace?
So the Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee that looked at all of that data had about 2 weeks prior to the meeting, which was held last September. It was actually released to the committee the same day it was made publicly available on the FDA's website.
Mm-hmm. And what sorts of material were available to you?
It was about a 172-page briefing package, which included information on the safety of the fish from a food consumption standpoint, and also information about how the construct was created, whether or not the fish grew faster or not, and information also included there on the environmental assessment that the company had done to look at the environmental concerns associated with the fish. I guess one thing, just I know environmental concerns are always something that people are concerned about, this fish actually getting out into wild populations. And the way that the product was being regulated through the FDA, it was proposed, and it is proposed, that this particular fish is going to be raised in land-based tanks, so on land in tanks, and it would also be a triploid female product, which means that all of the fish would be female, so they couldn't interbreed with each other, and also triploid, and triploidy would result in those animals being sterile. And so the company tried to have some risk mitigation in place to prevent any possibility of those fish interbreeding with wild populations.
Right. And just finally on this meeting, and this meeting took place mm-hmm. last September 2010, the conclusion of the meeting was that this group said to the FDA, we think that this is a product that you could approve for marketing.
Basically, the idea of the Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee is to look at all of the data that the FDA had looked at. The FDA's conclusion was it was a reasonable certainty of no harm from a food safety perspective, and also they looked at the environmental assessment, and basically the committee was there to look and see if there was anything that they had overlooked. And I think the conclusion of the committee was that they agreed with the FDA that there was a reasonable certainty of no harm from food safety perspective and also from the environmental assessment perspective.
And that reasonable certainty of no harm is one of those terms of art that means we don't think it's a problem. But
well, yeah.
That basically, I just wanted to make sure people understood that. Okay, so you said things looked okay, but Dr. Kapuscinski, I mean, obviously you and other scientists think either, well, tell me what you think. Did they not look at the data correctly, or did they not realize that more data was needed or were needed?
Well, I think my main concern was that the kind of data presented had gaps, and the quality of the analysis of the data, especially the statistical analysis, was really quite a low bar. So my main concern is that this application is really setting a precedent, and it's actually an application for a fairly small grow-out facility to raise some of these salmon in an undisclosed location in Panama. So this one facility doesn't really represent what's coming down the road. It's really more, you can think of it as sort of putting the camel's nose under the tent. But because it's going to set a precedent, it's really important that the quality of the science be as high as scientific standards would normally expect, and that the risk assessment is complete. So I was concerned that there were some problems with small sample sizes, some problems with statistical analysis, and I was even more concerned that there were key parts missing from the risk assessment. It seemed like the approach taken to the risk assessment wasn't really up to speed with the state of the art of risk assessment. So there were really three things that I thought were missing. One was the lack of what we would call a failure mode analysis, basically lack of a quantitative analysis of what could go wrong in the multiple confinement system that the company proposed. As Allison just explained, they have some biological confinement methods, which I think is a very good thing that they have that. And then they had also a number of physical confinement methods combined with that. The problem is with confinement systems, there are always possibilities of things going wrong and their interactions can be complex. And it's now a pretty standard practice when you're assessing a technology that you do a failure analysis. So that was missing. The other part that was missing is if some of the fish did escape, they didn't really go the next step of answering the question, well, what could happen if they did escape? And one might argue that there'd be a very low number of fish escaping, but it doesn't obviate the need to still do that second step of the risk assessment. And then finally, and in a way the most important, is the risk assessment lacked a formal uncertainty analysis. And this is really important, especially in environmental risk assessment, because there are always going to be scientific uncertainties. Living organisms and ecosystems where these fish might end up are very complex. There's a lot of variability. There are always things that the scientists don't fully understand. That doesn't need to paralyze, though, the risk assessment process. Instead, the state of the art in risk assessment nowadays is that you carry out a formal uncertainty analysis throughout the risk assessment, and you gather the results of that at the end, and you make that part of the conclusions that you hand to the decision makers so that the decision makers are much better informed about really what are they accepting and what assumptions are they making if they give an approval or if they give a denial.
Right.
So I think really in a sense I was worried that if this application is approved with these low standards of science and these missing parts of a risk assessment, and it sets the message, the precedent, that this is what the U.S. government will expect, and also many other countries are actually watching to see what the U.S. government will do because there are other groups around the world developing transgenic fish, that would just be a really unfortunately way too low a bar.
Right. I'm just curious, though. Alison van Eenennaam said that the expectation was that these fish would all be the ones that were released that would leave the breeding facility were all female and were triploid, meaning they were sterile. Doesn't that mean that if they got out, nothing would happen? They'd live their lives and then they'd die and that would be the end of it.
Well, it's not quite that simple. There are two things that we still have to think about. The first one is that there is some low percentage of fish in which the triploid induction, which makes them sterile, doesn't always succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because of this one application being fairly small, that low number, you know, it might be anything as low as 0.1% to 1% of the fish not being totally sterile. That low percentage might not be a problem for this particular case, but there should have been an actual failure analysis of that if this is, again, going to set the model for what you do in the future. So that's the first problem, because in future applications, you might have much larger numbers of fish, total numbers escaping, especially if this approval ends up triggering a proliferation of genetically engineered salmon being taken up by the salmon farming industry, which is a global industry, global commodity, then small percentages can add up when you're starting to have operations that raise anything from 500,000 to 1 million fish in a particular fish farm. But then the second issue is, if fish escape and they're sterile, they don't die out immediately. They still live in the ecosystem and interact with other organisms. So again, the question of scale becomes important. For this particular application, we were given really no information about the organisms living in the river in the undisclosed place in Panama. So it's really hard to know, are there other fish in that ecosystem that any escapes could interact with? If there are they fish that are endangered? We know that freshwater fish species throughout the world are in decline or in a lot of trouble because of other human impacts. So we need to have those kinds of questions at least addressed.
Okay.
And again,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but we have to take a quick break.
Sure.
And I want to make sure that we let Dr. van Eenennaam get some thoughts in as well. But stay with us. We're going to go through all this, and hopefully we'll come out of it with some clearer idea, although it's a very complicated issue. So stick around. We'll be right back after a short break.
You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about how a proposal to market genetically modified salmon is raising concerns. My guests are Dr. Alison van Eenennaam, an extension specialist in animal genomics and biotechnology at the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Ann Kapuscinski, a professor of sustainability science and chair of the environmental studies program at Dartmouth College. And I think I'd like to ask Dr. van Eenennaam, you heard some of the concerns about missing data or inadequate data or safety data that she would like to see. How does all that strike you?
Well, a couple of points. I think the FDA made it very clear that this particular approval was for the particular location in Panama that the company was proposing to grow these fish in, which again is an in inland tank location, and that's an FDA inspected site, and the FDA has been there and seen that there's multiple levels of physical containment, things like nets and cages and things to stop any fish from escaping there, and also the physical location of where the actual site is has a number of geographical attributes that would prevent those fish from, if fish did actually escape from that location, from ever reaching the sea. There's a number of thermal lethal rivers that the fish would have to get through if they ever were to escape. And so I guess we have to think about risk assessment in terms of there is a potential hazard, that is, that the fish escaped, but there's a number of risk mitigation that approaches that the companies put into place. And these are numerous and multiple and redundant. So let's just talk about the triploidy, which I agree is not 100% effective. So let's just say we've got 0.1% of the fish that are actually fertile, but then you've got all of these multiple redundant physical and biological containment measures in place to try to reduce the risk of any fish ever escaping down to zero. And I think you'll never say zero, but there's a number of multiple factors in place to try to minimize that risk as a result of all of these risk mitigation measures.
All right. Fair enough. But I want to include our listeners to this conversation because they, I'm sure, will have questions. So let's go first to Luke in Kansas City, Missouri. Luke, you're on Science Friday. Welcome.
Hi. My question is that why is there so much attention surrounding the genetically modified salmon when we've been consuming like modified vegetables and other foods injected with who knows what for years now?
Interesting question. Maybe Dr. Kapuscinski, you'd like to try that.
Sure. I think that there's that much attention for two reasons. One is this will be the first genetically modified animal approved for widespread commercial production and human food. But secondly, this kind of animal, a fish especially, is not that removed from its wild relatives and have much closer interactions with ecosystem than some of the vegetables that we grow. Also, we're dealing with a species, Atlantic salmon, that many of the places where it's farmed are also the native range of wild Atlantic salmon, and those are unfortunately, those wild Atlantic salmon populations are in deep trouble around the world. So that's not directly the case for this particular application, as Allison pointed out, but I want to come back to my earlier point that we have to keep thinking about the broader context here. This application is setting the precedent for what would be expected of an applicant to show environmental safety to a reasonable degree in the future. And if this application is approved and if the salmon farming industry decides that this is a good product for their business, then it's going to be adopted and farmed in places where there may not be as good confinement and where if the fish escape in some of those places like eastern Canada, the state of Maine, parts of Europe, where they can escape, interact with wild Atlantic salmon.
Right.
So, vegetables don't move around as easily.
Right. But there is also the case of, at least as Dr. Jan van Inenem said, about and they'll need their own applications, and someone will have to decide if their control measures are adequate. But let's go now to Roger in Commerce, Michigan. Roger, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey there.
Hey.
Hey. My main concern was that I complain here about genetically modified foods in general. I hear from a lot of people is complaints about not being safe to eat, which always drives me crazy. It's perfectly safe to eat. My only concern is, like what people were talking about earlier, is the problems of genetic diversity and getting involved with wild species. But couldn't it be perfectly safe if it was just in a controlled environment, unlike the certain Asian carp where it wasn't in a proper place? But right. If they were like raised, let's say, place or no floodplains or totally landlocked away from the ocean, say, give an extreme example like Nevada.
Right.
We have no problem growing it over there and even encouraging it.
Right. So, okay. So the question is, okay, thanks. So the question is, absent the ecological questions, is this fish safe to eat? And are you satisfied, Dr. Kapuscinski, that question has been answered?
Well, the food safety area is not as much my area of expertise, but I did attend the VMAC.
That's that meeting,
that committee.
The veterinary.
That committee, mm-hmm. Yes, and I heard some of the other comments and read some of them, and also actually read the report from the committee. And some of the concerns that were made that sort of resonated for me based on my having skimmed the food safety section of it was, again, concerns about small sample sizes and some problems with the statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the legitimate things to ask about is whether the engineering of these salmon has increased their allergenicity, and the data that was used to make conclusions about that involved only six fish.
Right.
And even the statistician on the Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee commented that, you know, there could be some ways to improve the statistical analysis, and there was a paragraph about that in the final report from the chair of that committee.
Okay.
So my concern there is also really about the quality of the science.
Okay. Dr. Von Inenum, what about you at this point? Are you more or less satisfied that this is safe to eat, or do you think there's still more to find out?
I'm comfortable that it's safe to eat. I guess I will touch on the allergenicity question because that's always an issue with genetically engineered foods. And the concern is that the protein that's being introduced through the genetic engineering would create allergens. For example, if you brought, a peanut protein into a fish, it might result in an allergen. And that is not the case in the case of the growth hormone that's in the salmon. And so the allergenicity question got down to the question of whether or not people that were allergic to fish would be more likely to be allergic to this particular fish. And there's really no consensus in the scientific or medical communities regarding the magnitude of an increase in kind of the endogenous allergens, the fish allergens, if you will, that would pose an additional risk to public health. And I think in the absence of knowing what level you're looking for, it's difficult to know what would be the appropriate work to do. We don't even know really the levels of allergens that are in naturally occurring salmon. And so in the absence of that information, it's difficult to know what levels would trigger concern. And we didn't see, in the absence of that information, it's difficult to make a determination.
Okay. Let's take another call now, and this time go to, how about Jerry in, Brian in Portland, Oregon. Brian, welcome to the program.
Yeah. I had a question about the failure analysis. I read an article about either this fish or a very similar fish, and the article I read was about 10 years ago, and it stated that if some of these fish that grow extra fast were to escape into the wild within, 50 years or something, they would supplant the wild fish because they grow so much faster.
Hmm.
And then they would destroy themselves because they would eat so much of the food so quickly, there would be a population collapse.
Hmm.
And this is a catastrophic failure. And this is a computer analysis I heard about, again, about 10 years ago. I wanted to know if your panel has heard of these people.
Fair enough. Thanks, Brian. What about that, Dr. Kopaczynski? Maybe you've heard of this?
I suspect that the caller is referring to a study that described a theoretical Trojan gene effect.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I anticipate that Allison and I probably agree.
Can you explain what a Trojan gene effect is?
Sure. The idea is that this engineered gene would give a mating advantage to the fish, for example, because larger salmon are maybe more successful at competing for a mate.
Mm-hmm.
So it would give them a mating advantage that would drive the engineered gene into a wild population. But then there's some other aspect of the gene that causes reduced viability in the offspring. And so over generations, that drives the population to extinction. Now, the problem was that the original model that was used to come up with this theoretical prediction was really very simplistic. And some geneticists questioned it at that time. Now we actually have some additional studies that have tried to add some of the things that were left out of that model. For example, the possibility of a evolutionary process, the fact that environmental factors can actually influence the actual traits of the fish, the way the gene gets expressed in the final things like the final size. So we now have pretty good evidence that all points in the same direction, that the Trojan gene effect is not very likely. However, I don't think that means then that there's absolutely nothing to worry about. There still are other important ecological effects questions.
Okay. Dr. Von Inenum, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I mean, I think there's some data that has come out that in this particular Fisher's case shows that they're actually would have reduced reproductive performance, at least the males would, relative to controls. That's a study that came out this year. But I guess my question is the relevance of that given the proposed containment that's associated with this particular application, and that these fish are not going to be interacting with the environment. The proposal is to have them on in land-based facilities.
Okay, fair enough. Let's now go to Jerry in Earhart, South Carolina. Jerry, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. If you would ask your guest to comment on the origin of the extreme resistance to genetic modification, because it just seems to me that for millennia we've been practicing husbandry with animals. We've been breeding them. We've been grafting plants. The only objection to me seems to be the speed involved rather than the quality of the product, because ironically the European resistance is on the quality and is it safe. Where from a layman's standpoint, it seems like the speed involved is the main thing and not the quality of the result, because we've been doing this for generations, for millennia.
Well, thank you for that, Jerry. So the question basically is genetic modification is the same as engineered in the lab is just a faster way of doing the same thing that people have always done in terms of breeding crops that they want or fish that they want or anything that they want. Dr. Von Eerenem, what about that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, the level of resistance to this. And I guess one of the things that I think is really important when we're talking about risks is having a look at what the current methods of producing food, in this case salmon, are, and we're comparing, I mean, all of the Atlantic salmon that's farmed is effectively imported into the US, and it's raised in net pens in countries like Scotland. And net pen aquaculture of salmon has its own ecological concerns. There's some pollution concerns, there's some disease concerns, there's actually escapes from those net pens. Of those diploid, fertile growth animals that have been selected for growth just through natural breeding ways that are getting out into the wild, and there's certainly some risks associated with that particular approach to aquaculture. And so I think when we're looking at the risks associated with genetic engineering, it's always important to have a look at the risks associated with the current approaches to raising fish. And this particular application, I might argue, is actually a more sustainable approach to raising salmon for aquaculture, because you're taking the whole product on land and removing any risks associated with net pen aquaculture and producing a more efficient, sustainable product for human consumption.
We're talking about the science and safety of bioengineered fish. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Science Friday from NPR. So, Dr. Kapuscinski, what about that? I mean, is there something special about genetically modified organisms that needs a higher level of scrutiny?
Well, the reason why people are interested in doing genetic engineering is because it has new powers, and it allows you to actually introduce genes that either were never in that animal or that are expressed at times that have never been expressed. So it really does have the potential to fundamentally change the biology of the whole organism. It doesn't mean it'll do that all the time, but that potential is there, and I think that's why there's interest in greater scrutiny. So an example with salmon is there's one study with genetically engineered coho salmon that also had a growth hormone gene added to them that showed that their tolerance of warmer temperatures changed, so that they actually grew faster at a warmer temperature than they would have at a colder temperature that's usually the optimal temperature for salmon. And with selective breeding, traditional breeding, we hadn't yet seen that with salmon. So that's an example of something new that you can do. In a way, the dilemma is that the very power of genetic engineering that makes it exciting and potentially a very useful tool for some applications also raises some new questions about unexpected effects, which is, I think, why we're getting more scrutiny.
I'm just curious, Dr. Kapuscinski. I mean, in the end of the day, can you imagine a time when you will have enough information to feel comfortable about saying this particular salmon or any genetically modified animal is safe to bring into the marketplace?
I think if the things that I was saying were missing were addressed, if there was a quantitative failure analysis, if some of the fairly important questions about ecological effects if fish did escape were answered, and if you did a good uncertainty analysis so that the overall quality of the signs and the completeness of the risk assessment were there, I would be much more comfortable with it. And the reason I keep pushing on this is I don't think it actually really makes sense to focus only on this one application because it is such a small-scale application. And we know that if it gets approved, it's then going to open the door to much larger scale use of these fish in many other fish farms. So if we, for example, come back to Dr. Van Eenemann's idea that if you were to shift the farming of salmon from cages to inland facilities, that that would be more sustainable, what we have to ask is, first of all, I don't know if the salmon farming industry would really be willing to do that, but let's say they did. When you shift it to inland, although you are now greatly reducing the escapes compared to cages, you are going to have much higher energy use and some other uses that...
I don't like to cut you off, but I'm afraid we've run out of time for this segment. It's one of those topics that's got people very interested and excited. But thank you, Dr. Kapuscinski, for joining us today. She's a professor of sustainability science and chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Dartmouth. And thank you also to Dr. Allison Van Eenemann, extension specialist in animal genomics and biotechnology at the University of California, Davis. After the break, we'll talk to molecular biologist Leslie Leinwand and what she learned about her unusual choice for a lab animal, a python. Stay with us.
No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. Next up, do you know that pythons can go without eating for months at a time? Well, there's a diet for you. But it's what their bodies, and in particular their hearts, do after they've finally had a meal after this long gap that's even more remarkable. What is that? Well, my next guest can tell us. Dr. Leslie Leinwand is a professor of the BioFrontiers Institute at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her study on the python heart appeared in the journal Science, and she joins us from Killarney, Ireland, where she was nice enough to interrupt her vacation to come onto the program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You're welcome. And if you'd like to join us, this heart study is just amazing. You got to hear about it. But it's 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, or you can tweet us at @SciFry. So, Dr. Leinwand, I guess that's the question. Why you're a molecular biologist, a biochemist, and you study hearts in humans? What got you interested in the python?
Well, when I read an article written by my colleague, Stephen Secor, a collaborator, and his colleague, Jared Diamond, about the amazing biology of these animals, I was immediately drawn to it. I have had such a curiosity about how they could go for such long periods of time without eating, and nothing terrible happened to them. And when they do eat, they eat this massive meal, and what happens is quite extraordinary, that the mass of most of their organs, including the heart, almost doubles in size in less than 24 hours, and then goes right back down again after they've digested the meal. And we were quite interested in that because we're cardiac biologists, after all, and we were interested in enlargement and how a heart gets smaller after it's enlarged.
So wait a minute. When human hearts get larger, sometimes that's associated with increased illness, but that's not happening here. Or what's going on there that's not going on here?
Yes, so... in many cases, people's hearts get larger because they've got high blood pressure that's untreated for, you know, many years, and that's a bad thing. But people like Lance Armstrong or Michael Phelps or a highly conditioned athlete also have bigger hearts, and that's associated with increased cardiovascular health.
Uh-huh.
So our hypothesis was that the pythons would not have evolved something happening with their heart that would be akin to a disease state, but instead might be more like a highly conditioned athlete's heart.
So why would these organs and the heart grow after a meal?
Because they need to be able to digest this massive meal. the meal can be equal to the body mass of the python, which is quite an extraordinary metabolic demand to be put on that animal.
So in other words, they just to finish eating their meal, to finish digesting it, they need a lot more energy and a lot more blood pumping through their bodies and like that.
Exactly, exactly.
I see. And why the python is a reptile? I mean, it still is not clear to me that anything it's doing would have any relevance to a mammal.
Well, we weren't sure that it would, but we bet on it. It was an instinct that I and my postdoc both had that we would be able to translate these findings into mammals. But to tell you the truth, it was one of the first experiments that the postdoc did after establishing that we could grow these reptiles and feed them the meals and their organs would increase. She asked a pretty simple question, which was if there was something circulating in the python blood that might be able to make heart cells from a mammal, a rat, in culture get bigger, which would mimic the python's heart getting bigger. And lo and behold, that experiment worked. I thought it was a big leap to go from directly from python blood onto mammalian heart cells, but it worked. And that gave us the resolve that if we did keep after this and study this organism, that we might, in fact, be able to translate the further findings to humans.
We're talking about a remarkable study involving python hearts that appeared in Science not too long ago with Dr. Leslie Leinwand. Give us a call if you want to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And it's something in the blood. Were you able to find out what in the blood was causing this growth spurt?
Yes, we were. We were able to identify three fatty acids, and those are basically the fuel of the heart that enables it to generate the energy that is required to digest this meal and pump this blood. And in terms of if you looked at the blood from these snakes after they've eaten one of these meals, they're almost milky. They're almost white with so much fat in it that it seemed like a likely candidate that it might be the fats in the blood themselves.
And they were a certain set of fats or ratio
yes.
of fats, or how did that work?
So it was a specific combination of three fatty acids that it requires just those three and in a certain combination. We've tested other ones, and it really is these three. And those three are not found typically in that combination in any, let's say, dietary source that a human might eat.
All right. Well, let's invite some of our listeners into the conversation, and let's go first to Doug in Denver, Colorado. Doug, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thanks very much to your staff for allowing my call through.
Sure.
I'm curious as to what happens with a python being as they are, reptiles, therefore cold-blooded, and in their environment a temperature change occurs that creates for a significant cooling, even as they're trying to or are working to digest one of their very often quite large meals. I've heard that they can eat an animal as large as a deer whole, and I'm wondering how cooler temperatures would impinge upon this biological effect or biological phenomenon of the enlarged heart, the increased blood flow, if suddenly temperatures were to turn cooler in their environments.
What about that, Dr. Leinwand?
Yeah, so certainly we nor anyone else that I know of has deliberately put the pythons in the cold after they have eaten such a meal. They do generate quite a bit of heat when they're digesting this meal, and as you probably know, the reptiles will stretch themselves out in the sun to generate heat or cool themselves down in the water if it's too hot. I would guess that a decrease in temperature that was extreme might have, you know, some physiological impact, but it might not be so relevant to where the pythons live in the wild normally.
Okay, Doug, thanks for that question.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Let's take another call now and go to Vic in New York City. Vic, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm wondering, what is the application, though, for humans? Is it for people who might be born with a defective heart? Somehow the mechanism, the muscle is defective? Or is this for people who have abused their or just, you know, been, you know, through their lifestyle have ruined their hearts and somehow this will undo that damage or help to repair?
Well, our hope is not that we would be suggesting that people take some pill instead of exercise, but it's well known that when people exercise, it's very cardioprotective. And when people with heart disease can exercise, it also is very beneficial. Unfortunately, many people who have heart failure, let's say, when the heart is not functioning well at all, can't get the benefits of exercise because they can't undergo that kind of exercise. So we're at least envisioning testing in animals whether or not these fatty acids might be beneficial in the setting of heart failure. And heart failure, as you may know, can be brought about by many, many different causes, and certainly lifestyle contributes to it, but it's by far not the only thing that can result in heart failure.
Okay, Vic, thanks very much for that call.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's now go to Eric in New York City. Eric, welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for doing this. I'm really excited about it because I work with snakes all the time. I've worked with reptiles for 15 years. And my question is, the fact that the snake's heart enlarges during the time that they're eating, does this affect the growth rate at all? Because I've worked with Burmese pythons. Actually, that's my other question. I'm sorry. What type of snake was it?
These are Burmese pythons.
What type was it?
These are Burmese pythons.
It was a Burmese python.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So I have had a Burmese python, and I actually still work with them now. And the one that I had, it grew from 1 foot to 3 feet. I'm sorry, 1 foot to 9 feet in 2 years' time. So in a very short period of time, it grew really fast. And at one point in time, I did an experiment where, not an experiment like, you know, official, but, you know, I fed it a whole bunch. I fed it about 9 mice at one time. And it ate all of these mice. And I remember literally, I was like, I want to measure it to see if it grew. It grew about 2 inches just from that one time eating. So my question is, does the growth rate, the heart size increasing, does that affect the growth rate at all, do you think?
Okay, Eric. Eric, good question. Thanks. So does the animal in toto grow or just these heart or organs?
Yes, so these are experiments where the animals have been fasted first, as they are in the wild, so they are not being continuously fed. Anecdotally, I can tell you that when we have done something somewhat similar to what you have done, we see that the animals just grow continuously and they get larger and larger and larger. And people are thinking that in fact, is what is happening with the pythons in the Florida Everglades, because their source of food is not so limiting as it is in their native environments. And so the snakes do appear to have a very, very large capacity to continue growing if food is plentiful. In their normal environment, food is not so plentiful, which is why they're these opportunistic predators. So these experiments that are in this publication that's being referred to are conducted on snakes that have been fasted. So the snake itself, with this one big, big meal, does not tend to get longer or its skull enlarge.
I'm wondering, though, these organs that grow, it's certainly the process by which they shrink is interesting, too. I mean, are they losing cells? Are they losing size of cells? I mean, what's happening in the shrinkage part of the story?
Well, I think I agree with you. I think that is equally interesting to the growth and is something that we've only just started understanding. One of the things that is true that when, and I should have said this at the beginning, when the hearts and the organs get bigger, they're not just swelling up with fluid. They're really building new tissue as they grow. So they've got to get rid of it somehow. And our suspicion is that it's going to be somewhat organ specific. I think in the case of the heart, we're expecting that the cells are going to shrink. I think in some organs where the cells are likely to be dividing, that they're probably going to lose cells. But as I said, I think it's going to be quite organ-specific, and we're excited about going into that new area of research.
We're talking with Dr. Leslie Leinwand about an experiment she did with pythons, or an observation she made in pythons about how their heart grows after a large meal. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Science Friday from NPR. So, Dr. Leinwand, What's next? I mean, what do you look for? Are you going to continue with snakes? What do you have to do next to extend this research?
Well, we're certainly going to continue with the snakes. We've kind of got our hands full with the experiments that we're doing now. And our next step is to try to ask whether these fatty acids will have some kind of beneficial effect in the setting of heart disease. We believe that this is a crucial experiment to do, and we're gearing up to do that. We're also interested in the potential to learn something about how snakes may be protected from various insults that would be toxic to you or me, such as these extremely high triglycerides, and we have some insight into that. Also, insulin levels appear to go very, very high, and nothing harmful happens to the snake. So we believe that there's a lot to be learned from many of the other organ systems in the snake, as well as understanding how the organs get smaller again after the meal is digested.
Okay, we have time for another call or two. Let's go to Sean in Butler, New Jersey. Sean, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is this. You mentioned about the snakes having a fatty blood. If you were to move this into humans, wouldn't that create problems for humans since we store fat and reptiles don't store fat?
So what we have seen so far is that because it is these three specific fatty acids, we are seeing no signs whatsoever of any kind of toxicity. We have put these fatty acids into mice and into just healthy mice, and we've screened for many, many markers and assays in the blood that would tell us whether we are creating any kind of toxic state as we would see with other types of fatty acids or individual ones, and we're not seeing any of that.
So, but it's not, I mean, you're certainly, you're a long way from saying take these fatty acids to improve your heart.
Oh, absolutely. We're very, very early stages. And that's why we're going quite slowly with these animal studies, because we want to make sure that we're not inducing any kind of toxicity. But as I said, so far we have no indications that we're inducing anything toxic.
Do you have any sense that we were talking that there are this healthy heart that this athlete's heart that the Lance Armstrongs have, where their hearts grow and grow stronger. Is there any sense that the mechanism might be the same between pythons, or might there be something completely different going on between pythons and humans?
Well, it's probably too early to say. We're going to be doing some experiments to ask about these fatty acids in the context of highly conditioned mouse athletes that run enormous amounts, and we can begin to probe that, but it's a relatively unexplored area.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this segment, and so, Dr. Leinwand, you can go back to vacation now.
Thanks so much, Joe. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. Dr. Leslie Leinwand is a professor of the BioFrontiers Institute at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessia Bayek. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rouse is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.